This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, last week, Neil Gorsuch took questions from the Senate Judiciary Committee in his bid to fill the seat that Justice Scalia had held for so long on the Supreme Court. One question that conservatives and liberals alike have been asking is, how does Gorsuch's legal philosophy compare to Scalia's? And to understand that, you have to look not just at the record of his decisions as a judge, which is important enough, but at his view of history. That's what Jill Laporte tells us. Jill is both a staff writer at the magazine and a historian. She wrote a fantastic essay recently about the Supreme Court, history, and the law. Now, Jill, before we get to Neil Gorsuch, I think you should start by describing what you call the history test. Not the kind of test that you give to undergraduates, I take it, but explain what this history test is.
Sure. Well, unlike the kind of test you give to undergraduates, this one is very difficult to pass because it's quite vague and uncertain. But the court, in trying to make judicial decisions, has several different ways it might use history. One is to look to precedent, that is, the body of earlier legal decisions. Everyone's going to do that to one degree or another. But then there's a broader deference to political, cultural, and social history. And justices sometimes talk about this as a history test. That is to say, does the way we decide this ruling, would it be consistent with the larger historical trends in American culture and life?
That's particularly used in constitutional cases, not criminal or civil cases. It's all at the top.
Right. So if you think about it, the Constitution doesn't have originally a Bill of Rights. Since the Bill of Rights, which is ratified in 1791, people have made other rights claims. And then the problem is, where do you find those rights?
So for example, what's a good case to sketch that out?
So the classic instance is the right to privacy, on which so much of our contemporary political debate hinges. The right to privacy is not written in the Constitution, certainly not in so many words. It is discovered in the Constitution in a case from 1965 called Griswold v. Connecticut. Estelle Griswold was the head of the Planned Parenthood Clinic in New Haven, Connecticut, and she challenged the constitutionality of bans on contraceptive services. And her lawyers argued that these bans were unconstitutional because they violated a right to privacy, which the Supreme Court agreed was to be found in the Bill of Rights in between the words as they are written, in the kind of shadowy, in the sort of spaces, in the kerning spaces between the letters themselves, was to be found the idea of privacy, and that it was therefore a fundamental right. But in Roe v. Wade in 1973, the justices did something a little different. They offered a historical rationale for the right to privacy. That is, Justice Blackmun looked at the history of abortion law in the United States to point out that only fairly recently had abortion become a crime, and therefore that a right to privacy did pass, in a way, this de facto history test.
So there's a general sense that conservative justices look to history and liberal justices look to contemporary norms. But what you're talking about seems a heck of a lot more complicated.
Yeah, it's gotten a lot more complicated. The reason I got so fascinated by this was I just have, for months and months, been still puzzling over Justice Kennedy's majority opinion in the same-sex marriage case from 2015.
Why so?
Because he goes on and on. He quotes Cicero. He quotes it. He talks about ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and it's just, it's full of a fairly extraordinary historical rumination. And when you see that much history in a Supreme Court opinion, just as your question suggests, it tends to be from conservatives. That is to say, the emphasis on history and tradition tends to come from conservatives. Because if you think about it, many of the rights that people have been fighting for, certainly since Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, are rights that earlier generations of Americans did not have. If you're trying to call for ending segregation, desegregating the schools, history's not the place to go for your argument, since segregation had been an American tradition. So most rights cases that came from the left or from liberals in the second half of the 20th century threw away history and tradition and argued using other forms of judicial reasoning, mostly, but also using other kinds of evidence, like social science.
Jill, a word that we hear, a concept that we hear all the time is originalism, and it's associated with the conservative side of things of the justices. But can we define what originalism means exactly?
Originalism was coined in 1980 and became the hallmark of the Reagan-era Justice Department. It means that the best way to interpret the law and all constitutional questions is to look for the original meaning and the original intention of the framers of the Constitution. So originalism has many adherents, but on the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia was by far the most powerful of them and the most eloquent, a really terrific spokesperson for this set of ideas. And after Scalia died, Neil Gorsuch gave a tribute address at Case Western Law School in which he talked about what it was that Scalia had contributed to American jurisprudence.
Perhaps the great project of the justice's career was to remind us of the differences between judges and legislators, to remind us that legislators may appeal to their own moral convictions and to claims about social utility to reshape the law as they think it should be in the future. But the judges should do none of those things in a democratic society. The judges should instead strive, if humanly and so imperfectly, to apply the law as they find it, focusing backwards, not forwards, and looking to text, structure, and history, not their moral convictions or policy consequences they think best for society. As Justice Scalia put it, and it rings true to me, if you're going to be a good and faithful judge, you have to resign yourself to the fact that you're not always going to like the conclusions you reach. If you like them all the time, you're probably doing something wrong.
But Jill, it sometimes seems like where the justices start is where they want the decision to land. And then they work backwards to find the history to justify that decision. Is that fair, that it's more politics than they'd like to admit?
I completely share your tendency to see it that way, but I don't think that's entirely fair. I do think that justices believe that they are examining the case on the merits, and that their understanding of history is so structured as to result in the outcome that they favor, but that they might see that it's history that's dictating that ruling rather than their politics. So I think what happens when liberals argue from empirical research, social science data, to argue against desegregation and to argue for women's rights and gay rights and same-sex marriage rights, what happens in the 1970s is that conservatives come up with their own judicial philosophy that is essentially a very narrow use of history, which is originalism. And that's where you get liberals using history differently and casting back, kind of out-originalizing originalists, casting back. No, we'll give you ancient history. Let me go to Cicero. And that's where that move comes in, right? It's the left saying, okay, we have who's going to bring the best history to this game? I have better history than you. My history is more interesting. My history is more thorough. My history has a longer timeline, especially in the same-sex marriage debates, right? It's the historical research of a generation of scholars that really makes a difference. So for Gorsuch, He's tackling this problem at a really interesting moment when originalism is in a certain kind of crisis, having risen to prominence not only on the court but in American public opinion. But these larger historical arguments that liberals have been making have been very successful, both in the public's mind and also on the court. So Gorsuch has written very specifically about the question of the history test, and I think fairly candidly states, depends what history you're looking at. Whose history? How far back are you going to go? If you want to find justification for a decision you're going to make, you can cater your historical research to find that answer and to justify that position. Gorsuch has been very frank about that in his own writing.
Is that similar to the style of thinking of Antonin Scalia? Not at all. It doesn't sound like that at all.
Have you read one of those Scalia opinions? No, Scalia would throw a book across the
exactly
room.
And hit you in the head with a sense of certainty, no?
I think a lot of people are still puzzling over what Gorsuch's jurisprudence will really look like. He is absolutely a textualist, very interested in the text, the original wording of the Constitution and its amendments, and also of previous rulings of the court. He is an originalist in the sense that Scalia was an originalist and that he believes that the best historical record and the first historical record to consult on any constitutional matter is the Constitution itself and the surrounding documents.
And the Federalist Papers.
The Federalist Papers, right. The things that people wrote at the time who were involved in framing the government.
How is that justified, though? In other words, why would you stop at the Federalist Papers?
The justification for originalism is, Scalia said, it's the lesser of two evils. That's the way to prevent the judiciary from becoming legislative.
One of the things that caught my eye in your essay is that you said that the framers themselves were not originalists. What did you mean by that?
So think about the revolution in the first place, the war for American independence. Its whole use of history is to say, let's just set history aside. History is a set of injuries committed against us by the King of England. What history tells us is that a people have a right to revolt. But we don't mean to make ourselves blindly venerate tradition. People in power often found their tyranny in an argument about the past. So we must always be able to criticize the past.
It almost seems like a kind of a fundamentalist view of a religious text.
Right. And legal scholars who have done careful work trying to understand why originalism exists in this country, there's this guy at Columbia Law School named Jamal Green, who's done a really interesting comparative study. Let's look at a few other former English colonies that have written constitutions and see, do they have originalism? And if they don't, why don't they? So he looks at Australia and Canada in particular. Former English colonies, they have written constitutions. They have nothing like originalism in their political culture.
Why?
He looks at a number of possible factors, and he decides it's because they don't have fundamentalist Protestantism in the country. And he argues that originalism, its appeal to the public, not necessarily to justices, but its appeal to the public lies in how closely it aligns with fundamentalism, that what you read in the gospel is the literal truth of God and that it is a revealed text in the same way that many originalists believe the Constitution to be divinely inspired. Who's waving the Constitution now is the political question I think worth asking.
Jill, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, David.
Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard University and a staff writer at The New Yorker.